This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with Quinn Hillier, the veteran columnist and commentator from the right, a native of New Orleans, former aide to Congressman Bob Livingston. Quinn Hillier, now based in Mobile, comments on why many in the GOP establishment, such as George Will, are calling for the ouster of President Trump, who remains extremely popular among conservatives and Republicans. Also on the show today, we'll visit with Jack Davis, a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor from Florida. He won the 2018 Pulitzer for History for his book About the Gulf, The Making of the American Sea. And we'll hear from Robert Fieseler in New Orleans. His book is about the fire at the Upstairs Lounge 45 years ago this week that killed 32 people. The person or persons responsible have never been found. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. And in Baton Rouge, the local dial is 297-5633. You can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start our show today with Quinn Hillier, the veteran columnist and commentator from the right, native of New Orleans, graduate of the Newman School and of Georgetown, and former aide to Congressman Bob Livingston. Quinn Hillier is a person who often speaks about what's going on in American politics from a conservative vantage point, and he even ran for Congress a few years ago. And we're going to talk with him about what's going on with the mainstream Republicans, some of whom are not enamored with Donald Trump, like George Will, who said that he's even encouraging Republicans to vote for Democrats. But before we get there, last night, just to show what is going on in this country and some unusual things that are happening on both sides of the political spectrum, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 28-year-old Latina running her first campaign, ousted 10-term incumbent Representative Joe Crowley in New York's 14th Congressional District. This is considered to be a stunning upset. Crowley outspent her 10-1, the fourth-ranking Democrat in the House, and the winner, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez, is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Quinn Hillier, what in the world is going on in our world right now?
Both sides are getting more extreme. American politics is moving to the extremes, and therefore the middle is harder to find. A lot of it has to do with partisan gerrymandering, making so-called safe Republican seats and safe Democratic seats rather than competitive seats between the two parties. Once you have a safe seat, then the real battle comes not in the general election, but in the primary. And usually in the primary, the more extreme activists win over the people that would otherwise have to fight for votes in the center. And that's what's happening here and in both parties. In the Democratic Party, leftists are winning again and again over centrists. In the Republican Party, conservatives are winning more and more over centrists. And it makes for more polarization, and that's not necessarily a good thing.
In 2016, Bernie Sanders ran a close race against Hillary Clinton. He almost got the nomination. If he had, how would the race with Trump have been? Would that have been a different kind of race? We know that, but would the outcome have been different?
I don't think so, because for every activist that Bernie Sanders added, people that weren't enthusiastic for Hillary Clinton or whatever, his socialism would have turned off even more of the moderate suburban housewives who might have voted for Hillary Clinton but would not vote for a socialist. So I don't think the race would have been much different. If anything, I think Trump would have won by more, but that's just guesswork.
Well, I mentioned George Will, who is acknowledged by even people on the left as having a fertile mind and a brilliant columnist. And his Friday column has kicked up a stir. He argues that voters of all ideological stripes should hand majority control of the Senate and House to Democrats in November. What's going on with George Will right now?
Well, he is, like me, appalled by Donald Trump personally, but he goes farther than I do. He says that Trump is so bad that he is bringing down the level of the presidency so much, bringing down the quality of civil discourse so much, that he thinks it would be better to provide a counterweight to him with a Democratic House, and therefore create divided government and sort of teach other Republicans a lesson that if they want to get their way, they need to stop following somebody like Trump. I don't agree with him. I agree with him that in many ways Trump is appalling, but I think his solution is cutting off your nose to spite your face.
The president, if polls are accurate, remains popular with conservatives and with Republicans. His overall numbers are 43-44%, about where they were when he won the election on Election Day 2 years ago. He could conceivably win another term. Quinn Hillier, how do you see this evolving with President Trump, with a good portion of the country solidly in his corner? He himself said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and many of my supporters wouldn't desert me, and I think he's right.
Well, he would be very, very difficult to beat in Republican primaries. Most incumbents are in their own party. I still think that he was quite lucky to beat Hillary Clinton, even though, as you know, I've been an opponent of Hillary Clinton's for 25 years, so I'm not happy that, I'm not upset that Hillary's not president by any means, but I do think he was quite lucky, and we can go into why. And therefore, I think if the Democrats put up somebody even halfway politically attractive, I think Trump has a hard time winning a re-election if he runs. But then again, if the Democrats keep going hard left like they just did in this congressional race in New York, Trump could get lucky again. And I'm going to say right now, the Democrat bench has not looked very impressive, and most of the people that seem to be making the most noise are either hard left or else they are, as in Joe Biden's case, 78 years old. So,
well, yeah, I'm to the point where I could believe just about anything. I could see Oprah Winfrey getting the Democratic nomination, which, of course, would mean a victory for Trump. I could also see Mitch Landrieu getting the Democratic nomination in a weird set of circumstances.
Let me jump on that, if I can.
Sure.
I have probably said more good things about Mitch and Mary Landrieu over the years than most Republicans or most conservatives. I have been very disillusioned by the last 4 years of Mitch Landrieu, so this comes from somebody that wants to give him a break, but has been very critical of him the last 4 years. Having said that, as critical as I am of where his second term went, I think you're right. I think Mitch Landrieu could be the, more moderate Democrat that actually could make a run for it. He is an absolutely superb public speaker. He is liberal enough, and his speaking skills are good enough that he could possibly excite the so-called Democratic base. But he's still got, enough moderation that he can appeal to the center and to the working class. I think he could be a formidable candidate. I don't want him to be, but I think he could be.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace, good morning to you, Phil. You're on Talk Louisiana with Quinn Hillier.
Good morning, Mr. Hillier. Good morning, Jim. I tell you what, what's going on with all of the people that are jumping ship off the Mr. Trump's staff and people that have been appointed and the people that he has appointed, and then this incredible tax break that he's given to people and companies that really don't need it, and then our standing in the world. I got to tell you, it looks like the Republican Party itself is the biggest danger to our national security.
Would you go that far, Quinn?
I would certainly not say the Republican Party itself is, and I actually think that one area that Trump has done pretty well on is national security. I think he finished the job against ISIS in a way that much quicker than I think Obama would have, or at least finished the job in Syria against ISIS. ISIS is still relevant elsewhere. I think he's bolstering our defense, which I think is a good thing. National security is not my complaint.
What about the ruling yesterday, the travel ban? He got a big victory. It was a 5-4 vote. The Supreme Court upheld the Trump travel ban.
Yes, they did. And I'm one of the few conservatives that think that the whole immigration issue is overblown by both sides. I didn't care much as a policy matter either way on that issue, but I do think the Supreme Court got it right as to what the president's powers are. In fact, I don't think it should have been a 5-4 vote. I think there's some areas where the president gets away with too much. Any president gets away with too much, but there's some areas where he does have powers that are fairly clear, and in this case, I don't see how he exceeded his powers.
877-217-5757 is your number for Quinn Hillier. We have another segment with him. Yesterday's 5-4 decision by the High Court was a victory for President Trump in the court's first substantial ruling in one of his administration's policies. It was also the latest demonstration of a newly invigorated conservative majority that is now possible because of the appointment of Neil Gorsuch as the deciding vote. Remember, Merrick Garland would have gone 5-4 the other way. We'll talk about it when we return. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing. 877-217-5757 is your number. New Orleans native Quinn Hillier, now based in Mobile. He is with us, a conservative of renown who writes for prolific publications and is, of course, a longtime member of the GOP, but is not enamored with President Donald John Trump. You and George Will are not the only ones, as you know, Quinn Hillier. The conservative intelligentsia, for the most part, is not thrilled about President Trump, but it doesn't appear to be hurting him among the rank and file Republicans. And in this part of the country where you and I are, the 11 SEC states all went to President Trump in 2016. If the election were today, they would probably all go for him again, with the possible exception of Florida. And it is a case in which we have a divided country, no doubt about it. Is the president stirring the passions in a way that is not good for the country, in your judgment?
The president is definitely stirring up passions in a way that I don't think is healthy for the American body politic. It does matter long term what the tone of our politics are. When you ratchet up the rhetoric so high, and you don't just demean the opposition, but attack them as being completely, you know, just evil, then you unleash not just anger but violence. And when you have violent politics, that's not a good thing. And Trump plays on that again and again and again. And the other side is now starting to play on that with Maxine Waters, the congresswoman from California, saying basically anything goes. This is not America. This is not how we should operate.
How do you see the midterm elections?
It's way too early, way too fluid. I mean, if you force me to make a prediction, I predict that the Republicans narrowly lose the House, which I don't want. I want them to keep the House, but I think they narrowly lose it. I do think Republicans still will pick up maybe one, maybe two net seats in the Senate. But you know, in a situation where the races that are out there should give Republicans a chance to pick up 5 or 6, and instead they might may only pick up 1 or 2. So I do not see a very good Republican year, but again, very, very fluid.
If the Republicans retain control of the Senate, and Quinn's not alone, most observers believe they will, that means a Supreme Court justice, if there is one in the second term of Trump, if that were to happen, would be certainly confirmed by the Republican Senate. That's a big issue, and many of the Democratic rank-and-file members of the Supreme Court, Stephen Breyer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, they're old people. They may not make it for another 6 years.
Yeah, well, look, if Trump somehow gets reelected in 2020, I see no way that both Breyer and Ginsburg make it through a second term of his without retiring or something. I think they're both going to try to hold out through his first term, so I think most people think the most likely retirement is from the so-called swing justice, sort of moderate conservative Anthony Kennedy, and he might announce as early as this week that he's retiring. But if it goes to a second Trump term, oh, absolutely, you're going to see probably both of those liberals, plus maybe Clarence Thomas, leave in a second Trump term.
Mm-hmm. With the precedent now set of a majority in the Senate upholding a nominee of a president, as Merrick Garland was upheld for more than a year, a vote was not permitted. Is that the new norm? Let's say, for example, that there's President Trump and the Democrats get the Senate. Does that mean the Democrats hold up any nominee he makes to the court until he's defeated or a Democrat takes office?
I'm afraid it might be the new norm extended, even, because in this tit-for-tat over judicial nominations that has been going on for a while, in which, by the way, the Democrats started, the every tact is more extreme than the original tit in the tit-for-tat war. Every reaction has been stronger than the original action. So if Republicans cited precedent to say that no Supreme Court justice has been approved in the last year of a second term of an opposing party, of an opposing party's president, they actually cited precedent for that, sort of dubious, but they did. Democrats, if they get into power, would likely go even farther. I mean, Democrats, if they get in power in the Senate, and say, well, we don't even care if it's the last year. We're just not going to approve them. And so they won't even bother citing precedent. They'll just say, we're getting you back from Merrick Garland. And then if Republican Senate got in with a Democratic president, they'd go even farther than that. Again, it's this escalation of tactics that is really worrisome to me for the long-term health of our republic.
David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on with Quinn Hillier.
You know, it's an absolute disgrace, the Supreme Court decision today regarding labor unions not being able to collect union dues from members belonging to public unions who don't wish to donate. And, you know, with all these sexual harassment stories in the news for the last few years, as a former AFL-CIO union shop steward for the largest steamship company in New Orleans, I'd like a lot of people out there to think about this. The only thing that prevented their daughters, their wives, their girlfriends, and their mothers from sexual harassment was their AFL-CIO union shop steward. And now I admit this was for a private company, but this is only the beginning of the attack on labor unions by the Republican Party, and it's an absolute disgrace. The bums, the freeloaders, the scavengers will get a free ride.
All right. Well, David broke the news that has just been released by the deeply divided Supreme Court, dealing a major blow to public employee unions. After 3 efforts in 2012, 14 and 16 fell short. The court's conservative majority ruled 5-4 today that unions cannot collect fees from non-members to help defray the costs of collective bargaining. Justice Samuel Alito wrote the decision with dissents from Justices Kagan and Sotomayor. 5 million workers affected by this, by the way. Quinn, the significance of this decision today?
Well, I'm glad the caller called in, but I have to disagree with his conclusion here. I think this is a wonderful decision. I've written about this case in the past. What this says is, if you don't want to join a union, you don't have to pay their dues. That's pretty simple. If you don't want to join a Kiwanis Club, you shouldn't have to pay their dues. If you don't want to join anything, you shouldn't have to pay their dues.
All right.
And that's all this decision says.
All right. Marie in Baton Rouge writes, what does Quinn think of John Kasich? Do you think he'll run in the 2020 Republican primaries against Trump?
I think John Kasich will run for president, whether he runs in the Republican primaries or tries to do a third-party/independent effort. I don't know yet, but he is extremely ambitious, and I see it as a 99% probability that he will run in one of those two ways.
Trump does not appear to be beatable in a Republican primary right now, though.
Yeah, that's why, you know, that's what I said earlier, that I don't think he can be beaten in a Republican primary if things go on the way they are, which is why even though the writer asked what I thought of him running in the Republican primary, I said either that or as an independent. It's becoming more likely that if Kasich runs, Kasich tries to run down the middle. If both parties go extreme, or if one party goes Trump and the other party goes extreme, then Kasich could say, I'm going to run right down the middle. And see.
All right, we do have to roll, but Quinn, it's always a pleasure, and we'll be calling on you again soon. Thank you for joining us, Quinn Hillier.
Thanks.
And we'll be back after this pause for the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is our producer today, and your number is 877-217-5757. You can email us talk@talklouisiana.org. It was 45 years ago this week, June 24th, 1973, that a man allegedly bought a can of lighter fluid at a Walgreens on Canal Street, walked up to the upstairs lounge on Charter Street in New Orleans in the French Quarter, emptied its contents on the stairs, and struck a match. Within minutes, the bar was engulfed in flames, and ultimately 32 people died. They were trapped in the bar. This is, of course, a story that is still reported, but at the time in New Orleans, it was quickly reported and done away with. A time in our world, 45 years ago, when incidents that involved the gay population were largely discarded. And writing about this is journalist Robert Fieseler. His book is Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge and the Rise of Gay Liberation. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. Happy to be here. It's so important that we talk about this, and I really appreciate your passion for this subject.
Well, thank you. Why is it the untold story?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. There was a ton of original research that went into my book, whereby new interview accounts, new primary source documentation, so many things that were swept under the rug in 1973, only through years and years of research, really I spent about 5 years on this subject, and even was discovering surprises in the last 6 months of me writing the book, came to light. So it's very interesting. I mean, there have been other accounts of the upstairs lounge fire, which are very worthy and very noble. Most notably, a mentor of mine, a guy named Clayton Delery, wrote a book called The Upstairs Lounge Arson, which I think is a real solid account of the book. When I had to do a sort of diagram about where did all the previous accounts on the upstairs lounge fire lay versus mine, I found that they all kind of sat in a kind of fringe corner, whereby if someone read that book, Clayton's book, for example, and then read mine, they're going to get two radically different accounts of this event. And much of the reason is because my event has a different frame to it that's never been really addressed before, which is the sociological institution of the closet motivated a lot of the sweeping of the upstairs lounge under the rug in 1973.
Yeah.
And then again, about 70% of the material.
There was no public memorial, for example. The mayor was Moon Landrieu. He mentioned it a few days later.
about two weeks later.
Yeah, yeah. And today, if something like this happened in New Orleans or any major city, the mayor would be, I'm sure, there on the scene at the time. But then it was pretty much just discarded. Governor Edwards never acknowledged the loss of life. And these are, quote, liberal Democrats we're talking about.
They are. They're very admired men. And with great, you know, great records in terms of racial civil rights. And even with Moonlander, he's a surprising, quiet supporter of his closeted gay friends in 1973. One of his largest fundraisers was a guy named Leon Irwin III, who was included on, you know, invitations to all of the mayor's events as a single man, as a quote-unquote bachelor. And he only really came out later in his life, actually. But actually, in 1973, Leon Irwin III was higher up in the Democratic social circles of Louisiana, kind of a powerful guy. But I think a part of the issue that I've discovered here is that some of these leaders did not speak up because there was a great long institution in Louisiana, New Orleans in particular, that you just did not address and speak up about homosexuality. You let the behavior exist, right? But you never gave it a name, because if you gave it a name, you made it dangerous and you provoked reprisals. I'm convinced some of the higher-up politicians did not speak about the Upstairs Lounge fire publicly in 1973 because they perhaps were protecting their closeted gay friends.
Well, and Archbishop Hannon, located just a few blocks away, barely mentioned it, and churches of all denominations refused to hold services for the dead people.
Correct.
It's hard to believe this was just 45 years ago.
It is. I mean, and it's interesting. So the Roman Catholic Church denied a couple of gay activist ministers, flew to New Orleans the next day after the fire, and were trying to really raise awareness about what was going on in terms of how the victims were being treated, what the families of survivors needed. And essentially, the Roman Catholic Church denied the use of St. Louis Cathedral, the Basilica, for a public memorial. And then weeks later, I found in my book, and this is a new piece of information, Archbishop Hannon, seemingly moved by guilt, then did, in a column of a small archdiocesan newspaper, did express words of sympathy for the victims of the Upstairs Lounge. And it's puzzling about why he would do it weeks later in such an out-of-the-way place where nobody noticed. It's taken years of researchers digging for this to find that he actually did speak up in 1973. And he was an informed man. He spoke about how the fire seemed intentional. He gave the correct number of the Upstairs Lounge dead. So this was a man who had been following the news closely and yet not speaking up even when members of the gay community were begging him to speak words of sympathy.
The book is Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge and the Rise of Gay Liberation, from our guest Robert Fieseler. 877-217-5757 is your number. Patrick on Bluebonnet. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air with Mr. Fieseler.
Yeah, I have a question. The person that started the fire, he was a homosexual that was kicked out of the club. Is that correct? So he was gay, the person that started the fire.
Is that known now?
Conflicted. Odds are it was an internally conflicted, that's the prime suspect, violent patron who was kicked out of the bar. There's a gentleman named Roger Dale Nunez who was kicked out of the bar about 30 minutes before the fire began. And as he was being kicked out of the bar, he screamed, "I'm going to burn you all out." Or another person heard him say, "I'm going to burn this place to the ground." The important thing is in a very noisy bar, both people heard the words "burn."
And you, many of these people were young, in their 20s. In fact, most were, which means they would likely still be alive. And there were some survivors, not many, but a few. And you interviewed some of them.
I did. Yeah. And those were some of the most powerful conversations of my life. So I, over the course of five some years of research, I was able to locate living survivors and living witnesses who had seen the Upstairs Lounge fire or been inside the bar when it was set on fire or left minutes before the fire began in the front stairwell that it served as the only entrance and exit for the public. And it was a process. I follow a Studs Terkel method of interview, meaning I give every source the wheel in terms of an interview. So it was sometimes a three-year email and text message dance with these survivors deciding whether or not they wanted to you know, really relive the worst thing that ever happened to them in their life. You know, it was so sudden. They were laughing. They were with their friends in a bar, and then a door opens, and, you know, they have 30 seconds to choose which way to run, and that within that choice is life and death. And then 3 minutes later, they either make it outside or they don't. And some of their friends or committed lovers don't. So these individuals who interviewed with me had to decide whether or not it was going to be worth really reliving the trauma, tearing off that bandage on a very old wound. And many of them were so brave to come forward and to give me that testimony. Some of that testimony actually happened. Individuals who were on the fence only had some of that testimony only actually occurred after the Pulse nightclub shooting. So an individual named Ronnie Rosenthal, who I'd been having a little bit of a reporter's dance with for several years, called me the day after the Pulse nightclub shooting, excuse me. And his reticence about speaking was then replaced with a sense of urgency. Meaning, I think he knew it was going to hurt so bad to talk about what happened there that day, but I think he sensed other people were hurting.
What happened, Robert, to the man who is believed to have started the fire?
Yeah, so he was a disturbed individual, internally conflicted homosexual. So he was actually located by the police and state fire marshal about a week after the fire happened. Then in mysterious circumstances, the NOPD decided that this is an injured man because he had his jaw broken in a fight at the upstairs lounge prior to being kicked out. And he was taken to the hospital and given jaw surgery and then left without guard. And then Dale Nunez then walked out of the hospital because he was without guard and disappeared, absconded from New Orleans for a few months, came back, and eventually just reengaged with a life of crime that he'd been part and parcel of before. So he was on probation for stealing, unauthorized mm-hmm. use of credit cards, et cetera. He eventually, it appears that he conned and married a woman who was about twice his age and who was financially independent. He only told her on their wedding night when they got married in May 1974 that he was homosexual, but that didn't matter because he was also impotent. So her heart was broken on her wedding night, and instead of her doing away with him, he somehow convinced her to let him stay in a backyard trailer at her residence, where he continued to steal from her, passing bad checks, etc., up until November 1974. Where he died by suicide, intentional overdose of several different barbiturates, and then he followed up those pills with 6 cans of beer.
Oh my! About a minute left. How did you get on this story? You're from New Orleans, but you didn't know much about it until you got to New York. What happened?
No, I'm not. I'm not from New Orleans. Actually, one of my mentors at journalism school, a guy named Nicholas Lemon, was a baby reporter in New Orleans in 1973. I was talking to him about another event that I was reporting, which was the burning of a Catholic church by the KKK in the 1920s. And he told me, "Have you ever heard of the upstairs lounge fire? It was this terrible incident. 32 people died. Only got a few days of national coverage, around a few more days of local coverage, and then it dropped off the local paper entirely." He says, "Have you heard of it?" And I said, "No." I was shocked. I thought I knew gay history. I thought I knew LGBT history, but my entire knowledge was skipping over from the Stonewall riots in 1969 to the assassination of Harvey Milk. And in between was this historically significant moment at a historically significant time period when so much instability was happening in our country, Watergate, end of Vietnam, et cetera.
Well, the book is Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge and the Rise of Gay Liberation, from Robert Fieseler, joining us from New Orleans. Congratulations, Robert. We'll be back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and our guest now is Professor Jack Davis. He is the Pulitzer Prize winner for 2018 in history. That is a distinct honor, and it's for his work, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. And good morning to you, Professor Davis.
Good morning.
Well, it's quite an honor to win the Pulitzer. I suspect in your wildest dreams, you probably didn't expect this to happen.
You're exactly right. In my wildest dreams, it came as a complete surprise. It's a wonderful honor. But more than anything, I see it as national recognition for the Gulf of Mexico. A wonderful sea we have around the bordering the southern states, and that often gets negative publicity in the news, and I think this is some really positive news for a change.
And it's nice to see somebody from an SEC school, the University of Florida, winning such a great honor.
Oh, you don't know how many times I've heard that. yes, that's right. I guess I have to say it. Go Gators.
Well, you're no newcomer to this subject. You've studied the Gulf for a long time, and of course you've written about other factors in American life, in particular in the South. But what compelled you to do such an expansive work about an expansive subject?
Well, I grew up on the Gulf of Mexico, and I have, of course, this lifelong intimate relationship with it. And after I finished my previous book, which is a biography of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who's been in the news lately, all for the wrong reasons, of course. But I was looking around for another topic, and the Gulf seemed like a natural fit, and nobody had written a comprehensive history of the Gulf of Mexico before, and I felt that it needed a history. It needed its history told. You don't find it in the history textbooks that you read in high school or even at the universities. And the BP oil spill occurred right about the time I was conceptualizing this book, and I felt as though that oil spill had robbed the Gulf of its true identity. And I wanted to reclaim that identity. I wanted my readers to know, who I always envision as American readers, not just Gulfsiders, and certainly not academics, because I didn't write this book for academics, but I wanted them to know that all Americans have both a historical and ecological connection to the Gulf of Mexico.
How have humans impacted the Gulf of Mexico? That's a big part of your book.
It is a big part of my book. As an environmental historian, I'm interested in that, but I'm also interested in how nature shapes the course of human history. And as far as how humans have had an impact on the Gulf, talk about the connection, referring to the connection I mentioned earlier. I mean, think of the rivers, in particular your river there, the Mississippi River. It drains some more than 40% of the continental U.S. And so whatever we put in the ground that ends up in the Mississippi River ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. And so the dead zone is a product of, unfortunately I have to say this, but, a Midwest agriculture. It's not a product of Gulfside activities. But engineering projects have had a major impact on the Gulf of Mexico as well, all around the Gulf. Disrupting the inshore currents, exacerbating shoreline erosion. The levees up and down the Mississippi, as folks in Louisiana are familiar with, speed up the water of the Mississippi, which shoots the sediment that is needed to naturally restore the Louisiana coast. Much of it goes out in the middle of the Gulf now. And of course, all sorts of agricultural industrial pollution, as well as wastewater pollution.
Jack Davis is with us, professor at the University of Florida and Pulitzer Prize winner for History 2018. His book, The Gulf, explores the age of the Spanish conquistadors to the present in a disastrous pattern of exploitation of this great waterway that many of us treasure and rely upon for our sustenance. Paul in Opelousas, good morning. You're on the air with Jack Davis.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Davis. Two short questions. In the past, it has been suggested that the meteorite that changed dinosaurs and everything landed in the Gulf of Mexico at the time. I guess it was in the Gulf. Is that correct? And I work in Hot Springs, Louisiana, and we're always fighting rivers and stuff like that. The Mississippi does change time to time. We know we can't control it. Do you expect it still just going to do what it wants to do eventually? Thank you.
All right.
Well, thank you for the question. No, a meteor did not create the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico was created with the breakup of the supercontinent, Pangaea, and the Gulf of Mexico is actually older than the Atlantic Ocean, because this great rift through the continent occurred right where the Gulf of Mexico is, long before the Atlantic was formed. And so I think it's a bit of a rip-off when geographers say that the Gulf of Mexico is a mere part of the Atlantic Ocean, which is not to say that there have not been meteor strikes in the area, and one major meteor strike, but that strike did not create the Gulf of Mexico. And I didn't quite catch the question about the river.
Well, I'm not sure where he was going with that, and we are a little short on time. But, Professor Davis, how do you see the Gulf in the years to come? There's great concern about the land around it, particularly in Louisiana, being eviscerated, and in New Orleans, long-term, and other cities are in peril. What's going to happen?
Yeah, we do have a major challenge ahead with sea level rise alone. And our best defense, and again, certainly the folks in Louisiana know this, our best defense against sea level rise and shoreline erosion is to preserve the living shoreline, whether it be coastal marshes or oyster beds or mangrove forest. Those mitigate the impact of sea level rise much better than a concrete seawall, and which actually contributes to erosion. We know how to stop the erosion of Louisiana of the Louisiana coast apart from sea level rise, but you know, there just isn't the political will there, at particularly at the federal level. But in the past, there hasn't been the political will at all at the local level either. There are a lot of heroes in my book. These people who work around in bays and bayous around the Gulf of Mexico, restoring those living shorelines, keeping those bays and bayous healthy. Hundreds and hundreds of them are volunteers. Hundreds and hundreds of them are low-paid employees of nonprofits. I do have hope, because we know how to do it. We've cleaned up the bays and bayous that were virtually dead bodies of waters in the 1970s. We've accomplished that. I think we can accomplish these other challenges, or meet these other challenges.
Tracy at the Capitol here in Baton Rouge asked if oil and gas exploration has affected the Gulf immensely.
It has. It's affected the Gulf immensely. The exploration itself is... has an impact on marine life, and then of course if oil and gas is discovered, then you have a well. But you know, the real damage from the oil and gas industry comes from the inshore infrastructure. Yes, an oil spill is a horrific thing, the BP oil spill in particular, because it took unnecessarily many lives. But it's not the worst environmental disaster that the Gulf has suffered. The worst environmental disaster is every day on the Gulf of Mexico, when you think about that inshore infrastructure that supports that industry and other industries as well, and those engineering projects and what comes down those rivers.
Well, you have spent much of your career not so far from the Gulf, and a graduate of South Florida, by the way. South Florida, and you taught at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, so Jack Davis knows the South. And are we sometimes neglected, or perhaps not getting the attention we should as citizens, and the Gulf as our resource because of where we are?
Yes, and I'll give you an example. Before the BP oil spill, scientists studying the Gulf often had a difficult time getting grant money because the granting agencies weren't that interested in the Gulf of Mexico. Oil spill happens now; it's very easy to get grant money, depending on your project, of course. But, yeah, I still think that the Gulf of Mexico is neglected. I think, the policymakers and the American people have a very narrow image of what the Gulf is. Most people don't know it's one of the most productive estuarine environments in the world. And as a consequence or as a result, we have one of the most productive commercial fisheries in the United States. And we have $1 billion sport fishing industry. Things I wanted people to know about the Gulf, I think are important to understand the identity of the Gulf, and that it is this very important sea to our livelihoods, to our natural and our national heritage.
The book from Jack Emerson Davis is The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. Congratulations on your Pulitzer, and thanks for spending time with us, Dr. Davis.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.